Welcome to this podcast on Jazz 625 and BBC Two. I'm joined by Richard Wallace at the Department of Film and Television Studies at the University of Warwick.
Hello.
I'm Tim Wall, Professor of Radio and Popular Music Studies from Birmingham City University.
Hello.
And I'm Nicholas Pillai, also from the Department of Film and Television Studies at Warwick. Well, BBC Two's just celebrated its 50th anniversary. And in April and May, there's a Jazz at the BBC season, which is taking place across TV and radio. One of the programmes that's scheduled is a BBC Four celebration of Jazz 625. And this podcast is sort of a complement to that. So we're here today to discuss Jazz 625's production, its cultural value, and its legacy as music television. I suppose the story of BBC Two begins actually in 1962, doesn't it, with the Pilkington Report. This was a government inquiry into broadcasting, which recommended the institution of a second channel. Richard, could you tell us something about the Pilkington Report?
Well, I suppose the key issue here was at this point we had two main channels, BBC and ITV, and the idea was that the third channel was going to be awarded to one of those two, probably one of those two institutions. And the Pilkington Committee was set up and devised to decide which of those broadcasters would get the third channel. The key thing here is that the key reason why the BBC was awarded it rather than ITV was that the BBC was seen to uphold those kind of integral notions of public service broadcasting, that idea for kind of John Reith kind of came up with in the 1930s about, you know, informing, educating and entertaining. That ITV, this was something ITV wasn't doing. It was too commercial, it was too popular, it was a bit kind of seen as being a bit trashy. It wasn't really upholding those values. So, but BBC One was very much doing that, and the idea was the third channel would be awarded to BBC so that they could diversify their television output to allow alternative programming, that the BBC One could do the kind of mainstream popular television, and that second BBC channel would be there to cater for niche audiences, specialist audiences. So I suppose what's important about BBC Two here, it's no coincidence that BBC Two and Jazz 625 are both celebrating 50th anniversaries pretty much on the same day. We could say that there's a nice link here. You know, you could say, well, obviously it was on BBC Two on basically the first night. I mean, actually the second night, but essentially the first night. Nick, you might say more about this in a second. But there's a reason, which is that I think it's probably safe to say that Jazz 625 probably couldn't have existed on BBC One. It needed that more niche channel as an outlet. So those two things in some ways go hand in hand. That idea that Jazz 625 is a flagship programme on within in the first week of the launch of the new channel is significant. And that kind of comes from that kind of Pilkington report that came out in 1962, which essentially awards the BBC its second television channel.
I suppose another element of difference between BBC Two and BBC One is that there's a sort of new generation of programme makers. Famously, John Reith had expressed disdain of jazz.
That's not strictly true.
Oh, is it not?
No, that's one of those...
Is it a myth?
That's one of those things that people like to say.
Okay. Yeah,
and they pick on a quote and then choose some words from that quote.
Well, I was going to ask you if jazz had a presence on the BBC before 625, and I suppose further to that myth of John Reith, was it treated with suspicion or was it welcomed as a form?
I'd say it was one of the key battlefields, really. I think jazz on the BBC is interesting because it wasn't any one thing and there wasn't any one group who was deciding. I mean, it's often presented that the BBC is John Reith, but I'm not sure that's strictly true, although he was a powerful personality. Probably the main thing he succeeded at doing is making the BBC a national organisation in the sense that you could hear it wherever you were in the world, and that world was Britain, and that world came out of London And I think that those were probably the things that he contributed. His cultural control was something that he was always trying to assert and was always resisted. And one of the battlegrounds was jazz. Mm. And I think, I mean, the other thing to say is, of course, Reith didn't stay at the head of the BBC for very long. Mm. So what we mean by Reithian is different. And I agree entirely with the way that Richard set it out. I think what was interesting about BBC and Pilkington was it was an attempt to actually rethink what public service was for the 1960s. And the fact that this is the 1960s is not something that we should sideline. That's going to be really important to us. So when we're thinking about jazz, there's a question about, well, what is jazz in the 1960s? And particularly, if the world is Britain for the BBC, what was British about jazz? And they're probably the ideas that everybody was fighting over. Mm. So it's popular to say that the BBC, when it was a radio service, didn't pay proper attention to jazz, but I don't think that's true. You could argue that the majority of the BBC's output in its early days, in the 1920s, was jazz, in the sense that every single night there would be a dance band programme that would take up a major part of the outside broadcasting. Now, what is interesting is, for some people, what those musicians played wasn't jazz. Mm. But for Reith, it was. Mm. And so that famous quote about jazz, he actually says, "We shouldn't only play jazz." Mm. Now, that's a very different a notion. And, of course, the struggle in the 20s was between jazz as a popular music. And so let's just think about those radio programmes in the 1920s. They were from Mayfair hotels. Mm. So what is jazz? Well, it is a particularly London-based entertainment. It's very modern at the time. It has a shocking flavour of American society within it. Although I don't think we would hear that today. We would hear a music that was very polite. There were always singers involved, and they would sing in very polite English southern accents. So, but jazz was dance music.
Yeah.
So, and it took place in posh hotels in the West End.
Yeah.
And what the BBC did for a national audience was, as far as the BBC was concerned, was give people access to that world that they wouldn't experience in any other way. Mm. So that's what this sort of national public service was all about. But there were a group of people who were besotted by the sounds of a particularly black American jazz, and they could hear that on record. Mm. And this changed their world. If they found Britain a stifling place, this was a window onto another world of excitement that seemed to speak to them. And they wanted the world to hear that, and they wanted the broadcaster to do that. And they were only a very small group of really committed people. So broadcasters were by and large not necessarily going to do that. So you get this struggle between the narrow cast, just picking people up and applying specialist ideas. And really the history of the BBC is moving from one service for everybody and starting to divide up. So by the 1960s, we'd already had a series of changes. We'd had a national service, but then that got subdivided into a home and a light service in particular, and then a very specialist third programme. And they did play some jazz, but they treated it as you would small form art music of other sorts. And so you would have the variety department, who would treat jazz as a form of entertainment, and then a small subset of jazz as art. And probably the programme that radically changed it was Jazz Club.
Yeah.
And the club, in the word jazz club, is not the Mayfair Club, but is the record listening club.
Yeah.
So this picked up a tradition of those aficionados who had taken their records, would get to together in a small room. If the club became bigger, it would be a pub, a back room of a pub, and they would play and listen and mainly talk about the records. And I think that that's the foundation of Jazz 625 as a notion of jazz. Mm. It's an aficionado's music. It's introduced and talked to. It's appreciated like a piece of classical, small form classical music is. And so in a moment in which BBC Two tries to reinvent public service broadcasting and its commitment to the arts, to also try to reinvent commitment to science and to other important things in British intellectual life. But it is interesting that on the first night, jazz is at the heart of British intellectual life.
The interesting thing about Jazz 625's place on the schedule is sort of harking back to what you were just saying, Tim, is it's surrounded by programmes about finance, engineering, science, but actually is a programme produced by the Light Entertainment Division. And I think when one looks at the internal memos within the BBC, there was a kind of anxiety over this. Certainly music and documentary felt like jazz should be its province. And I suppose there was a fear that jazz would be trivialised. As you've said, it wasn't. And the producer of Jazz 65, Terry Hennebury, I think was very concerned with how camera work, lighting would contribute to a visual effect that contributed to the music produced, but also how there's a kind of a world created around these musicians. Hennebury had previously worked on the radio, had worked on Jazz Club for 4.5 years, and he brought Jazz Club's presenter, Steve Race, the critic, over to Jazz 625. I wondered, Richard, if there were any points of comparison between Jazz 625 and the other forms of music on the BBC, pop music, for instance.
Well, I mean, I think one of the striking things about watching Jazz 625 in context is its liveness.
Yeah.
I think, you know, now in this kind of post-Old Grey Whistle Test, post-Jules Holland era where we're used to seeing live, you know, Glastonbury coverage, we're used to seeing live music on television, you might be going, well, what, you know, why is that important? But actually, if you looked at the landscape of kind of pop music on television at that time, the idea that you would have people in the studio playing live and that is the point of the show is somewhat different to what was going on around it. So, I mean, if you look at some of the other music programmes that are on television at that time, you know, you'd have things like Jukebox Jury on the BBC, which kind of run from the late 50s to like 90s. You know, this is where the latest singles are played to a panel of experts who judge whether it's good or not. You'd have things like Thank Your Lucky Stars. Again, this is on ITV in the early to mid 60s, which usually would see you know, some of the big name pop stars of the time turn up and mime to their own records. Ready Steady Go, which starts at the end of August 63 or start of August 1963 on ITV. Again, this is the same. You know, it's you get lots of different acts in and they all mime to their records. Top of the Pops starts on New Year's Day 64, so you've got Ready Steady Go, ITV's version, Top of the Pops, the BBC's version. And again, if you look through the BBC, the paperwork at the BBC's archives, you know, for Top of the Pops it is things like Searchers miming too,
yeah,
the Beatles miming too, the Rolling, yep, Stones miming too. And this idea that there's what's important about those programs is being able to hear the single and see the artist, but the link between the performance and the performer is not important in those programmes, or it doesn't seem to be important. And I think this is, as we think about somebody like the Beatles, I think this is emphasised in, you know, the live act, where actually people would go to the live act and scream. So actually hearing the music is not as important as just being in that same space.
So in pop music, there's a sort of schism, perhaps, between the image track and the visual track.
Exactly. Yeah. The often what you've got is either, you know, just a copy of the single being played, or occasionally that it would be a backing track that had been pre-recorded. But it's often the, you know, it's very unusual at this time for the music to be being played live, and the exceptions tend to be if it's something broadcast from a theatre. So things like Sunday Night at the London Palladium, you know, that runs throughout like the 1950s and the 60s. And, you know, if you have acts on there, then they generally are playing live, but they're playing live to a theatrical audience, which is then being broadcast on television. What's interesting about Just 65, it seemed to be one of those first attempts to make a music programme for television, that where the live performance is important. When we've talked about radio, this isn't the case in radio. On radio, if you've got bands on radio making radio appearances, almost always they will have recorded live sessions because you can't see them. So, of course, on radio you need something more that can be heard, and doing a live version of your latest hit is, or doing a cover version, that's interesting. But the ability to see the Beatles on Top of the Pops is enough, or seems to be enough. BBC Two is interesting because, of course, you've got Jazz 65 live, kind of on the opening night of BBC Two. And then later in that week, there's another programme called Pop Beat, which, again, seems to be a kind of performance of live acts. So you have the Rolling Stones, you have the Searchers, you have Jerry and the Pacemakers, each doing kind of 4 or 5 song live sets. But again, this is broadcast from the Royal Albert Hall.
Yeah.
So it's unclear whether that's, on the one hand, you've got two music programmes on BBC Two in that opening week, both live.
Yeah.
One of them is made for television, the other one is a programme from the theatre. So it kind of follows that tradition. But I think liveness is key. And what's really interesting is that about Jazz 65 is really that sense that it's doing something different to what's going on around it.
And I think one of the things when I first saw Jazz 65, it impressed me was the distinct way it looked. I mean, one of BBC Two's sort of innovations was it was broadcast in a sort of new 625 line UHF technology that promised greater clarity of image over BBC One's 405 lines. I suppose crudely it was a sort of HD upgrade. But I wondered, Tim, how innovative you thought Jazz 65 was as a programme.
Well, for the BBC, substantially. Mm. It's interesting if you look at other world broadcasters. If you went to the States, for instance, people had been making pretty similar programmes for some time.
Yeah.
In the late 40s, you're starting to get an equivalent starting to appear.
Yeah.
The one that's usually noted is The Sound of Jazz. And again, these programmes are always interesting in their titles because they seem to suggest what's important.
That's so right. Another
625 is signalling that quality that you're going to get of vision. But actually, you also got a quality of sound, I think, both in recording and in broadcast. And if you got the right TV set, reception.
Yes. The
American program, which is on the CBS network, is talking about the sound of jazz.
Yeah.
And there's a big introduction about that. But you'll see many of the same qualities, so I suppose, and the positioning of the camera. And in the CBS programming of the decades before, it sort of moves around on a fixed plot, but it tries to create this idea of following people through things. It's almost experimental theatre in my head,
yeah.
I think,
yeah.
Because these were often made by American drama departments, interestingly, and they were often in strands that the next week you're likely to see some sort of experimental television theatre.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. It was certainly a move forward for the variety department, but I think they took that as a challenge because they wanted to make almost, well, what should the light department, sorry, it used to be called the variety department, move around through the musicians. There's a great focus on the playing hands of the musicians.
Yes.
You will see close-ups of the keyboard and the player. You'll see the expression on the bass player's face and then his hands playing the drum roll. And there's an attempt to try and capture, to picture what's happening musically. So clearly a lot of thought's been put into this is a piece of music.
Yeah.
We should come back to this issue of liveness in a second, because it's about as live as we are. Yeah. You know, liveness is a construction of the television industry. It doesn't matter that it was or wasn't actually happening at the same time as people were looking at it, but you're absolutely right. Its sense of being both live and alive is really important. So it's almost as if here are musicians and we have entered into their world. Yes. It's a very different world than the one that Richard described before, which is a world of presenting yourself to an audience and that experience being televised. There's an extent to which this was thinking through what television could be.
Yes.
What could music television, what could jazz television be?
Yeah.
And I think the heart of its experimentalness and its newness is that the producers started with that question, and you've talked about the fact that often those people had backgrounds on radio.
Yeah.
The easiest thing would have been to make it radio with pictures.
Yes, and I think that was the concern of, you know, people in music and documentary. They thought, you give it to people who've worked on radio before, they're going to just produce a radio programme and they're going to point a camera at
but
it.
But no.
No, absolutely
it's
not.
It's absolutely not that.
What's interesting is when you look at the camera scripts, you see that initially there was a sort of plotting of how a piece would be played. And then I think in response to the musicians rehearsing, then those camera positions have been replotted and reworked. Perhaps that's another thing we can add to this unpacking of liveness, is it's actually a liveness that's constructed around the music that's being produced. A sort of expressive.
That to me is exactly what's going on when you feel like the camera movements and the editing is dictated by what the musicians are doing and the playing that they're doing and the things that are interesting, rather than this is where the camera's going to be. If you want to be on screen, you need to stand there. It's absolutely that responsive production model, which kind of says what's important here is the performance, and we need to capture the performance, not you need to perform for the camera.
Yeah.
I think that's what's so kind of in a way revelatory about watching that.
There's lots of things we don't know here, aren't there?
But yes.
Clearly that first and subsequent programmes came from some experiments that Hanbury did himself, because what's interesting to understand is how you move within the BBC at that time, and it still applies to some extent, but people would move between departments and would progress their career entirely within the BBC, and you did that by going on secondment. Yeah. And by going to one of the many BBC training organisations. So in order to move to TV, or back to TV to some extent for him, but in a new role as a creative lead, he had to go on a course and be taught. And, of course, they were being taught about the new technology that was being developed for BBC Two. So he would have had that very much in his mind. And almost like their graduating project, they had to do a few things to existing scripts, but they had to go away and devise something themselves. And Hanbury's attempt was, let's make a jazz television programme. So I'm sure that the heart of that was that attempt to explore and to look at what jazz on television would be like. And the story he tells anyway is that he then took that tape. And wouldn't it be fantastic? I don't know if we can get it. I have tried. Whether it exists, but it would be wonderful to see what his experiment was there.
Yes.
Or find other routes to, and then compare it. Because actually the pitch, and I think we'll talk about this in greater detail later, was slightly different. It was a more expensive and more expansive programme, wasn't it? But
yeah.
I'm sure that experimentation came from that time of focused on this new technology. How do I become a TV programme maker when I know how to make radio programmes? And that's something distinctive about the BBC.
Yes. I mean, my understanding of Hanbury's original conception of the programme was that it would be shot on outside broadcasts. There was the thought that they were going to film exclusively in clubs, in the Mermaid Theatre or the Mayfair Theatre. But we discussed this before we came into the studio, actually, that one of the really distinctive things about Jazz 65 is it different episodes are set within different locations. So
some in clubs. Yeah.
Yes. So some Marquee, in the Marquee yeah. Club yeah. on Water Street in Soho, but others in BBC Television Theatre at Shepherd's Bush or at Television Centre. And I think that really introduces a sort of visual distinctiveness, again, which sort of responds to individual musicians or individual groups, I should say.
Well, there's a really wonderful variety about it, which is in contrast to so much music television, which says this is the format, this is the room that you do it in, and every episode looks the same. That idea that there's kind of there's an idea for what the programme is, but that idea is flexible. So you can look at some of those episodes, and you know, some episode of Jazz 65, you've got the presenter who says, "And you know, here's a performance by a modern jazz quartet." You know, performing this number, and it'll go to them and then cut straight back. In others, I mean, the Dizzy Gillespie one, I think, is a good example where the presenter throws it over to Dizzy, who then
takes over.
And so that idea that there's no, it's not, we'll go to you and then you will play. It's we'll go to you and you can do whatever you want, whatever's your thing, is really interesting.
Because one important thing we ought to say is we can see this. This is very unusual for a lot of BBC TV, particularly that was labelled as entertainment. It was either just broadcast and there was no record of it as a audiovisual text at all. And they actually recorded these, even the ones that were broadcast live.
Yes.
So they actually put them onto film.
Yeah.
Videotape not being a technology that was really available at that time, so we can actually look at these. And we were saying this before, some are so sort of tightly I have an impersonation which is no good in a sound recording, but you know, the camera's really tight in on a small group of people who are hunched up in a small space as an audience members
with hardly room to clap.
But with hands inches apart, and then this expansiveness that you were describing, so you get that variety. But I wonder how much of that was almost forced upon them because they wanted a particular act.
Yeah,
we shouldn't call them act, should you? In this context, a particular group or performer, and you had to go where they were, or perhaps it was thought that they were more suited to that atmosphere or that place.
A lot of the American performers that they got were people who were touring the country, and it seems that often the way
this was one of the innovations as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the ways
hard to believe now.
Perhaps we should say, sort of between 1935 and 1954, the Musicians' Union had imposed a ban, which had been upheld by the Ministry of Trade, which prevented, or at least made it very difficult for American jazz musicians to play in Britain. By 1964, that ban had been relaxed, but it was still working on a sort of one-for-one system. You know, we get Oscar Peterson, you have the Dave Clark Five. And so I think that's another real innovation of the programme, is that suddenly you see these American musicians, and sometimes very close up, you know.
And of course that goes back to those radio days.
Yeah.
When the jazz fans wanted the original.
Yes.
American, often black American music, and here now for the first time was the possibility to do that.
But what Jazz 65 doesn't do, I think, and it's to its credit, is it doesn't make a sort of false division between American jazz and British jazz, and often we'll see Americans and British players sharing the stage, and I think that's very valuable.
And or having separate programmes, yeah. I mean, a large number of the programmes were about entirely devoted to British musicians, so yeah. and a remarkable variety of jazz.
Yes,
I mean, there wasn't a perspective, and that's quite, maybe we should say this as well, possibly in the last 22 years or so, there had been a real strong commitment to this is real jazz, and another group of people, no, it isn't, and basically a split between people who wanted it as some 1920s originated folk music and other people for whom it was a startling modern innovation. And we not only get that variety, but we sometimes get musicians sharing a performance who would come from those different traditions.
Yeah.
Again, I think that owes some sort of debt to the American way of doing things. Some of the earlier American programmes also had that quality.
The Sound of Jazz has got a curious group of musicians, doesn't it?
It has, and probably the Sound of Jazz is rooted in a series of live events which tried to take the history of jazz and put it on. The Carnegie Hall was one of the places that it was presented, but it acts as a symbol for all of those sorts of stages. The prestigious concert stage that would normally have a classical composition in, but it had that same educational function that we get in 625 that Richard talked about at the beginning, was a real important part of the BBC to remit. So all of these things are sort of coming together, and I'd add the final ingredient. It was probably the first time that British jazz musicians were having a greater confidence about themselves, and people were speaking about a British jazz as if it was different.
Yes.
The sort of playing together is often, on the stage, is often as much that tradition that started to happen, because when the American musicians came, British Musicians Union would allow them for the first time, but they couldn't afford to bring their band from New York, so the soloist might come on. And if you play at Ronnie Scott's club was particularly good at bringing those musicians over, you'd have the house band playing with them, and often the format is, it recreates that, and the link to Ronnie Scott's was quite strong.
The Ben Webster episode's a good example, where you have the pleasure of seeing Ben Webster playing with Stan Tracy.
Yes.
So I suppose that leads us on to thinking about the legacy of Jazz 625. For many of our listeners, I suspect that the idea of jazz broadcasting is inevitably tied up with John Thompson's character in The Fast Show.
And of course, I think that's really unfair to make that connection.
No, we're going to get to that. as soon as that character's mentioned, everybody around this table is sort of chuckling a little bit. There's that... You know, so I suppose one of the features of John Thompson's character is the address to a camera in a sort of dimly lit studio. There's the catchphrase, nice. There's the descriptions of music which obsess over technique rather than effect. Tim, you don't think, really, that that Fast Joe character is a Jazz 625 character?
Well, of course, all those things you've just said are right.
Yeah.
But they are, I think, characteristic of other sorts of programming.
Yes, and perhaps the next step after Jazz 65.
I think so. I mean, there are actually examples in the old grey whistle test in which Bob Harris turns to another camera, and if he doesn't say cool, it's pretty clear. I mean, I can't quite from memory bring it, but he does do this, and the camera was set up, and I have seen interviews in which the Fast Show people say, yes, that's actually what we took. Mm. But it is a skit on jazz television. Of course it is. Of course it is. But I suppose what I want to say is that isn't how 625 was.
No, and it would be a disservice, really, I think, to the presenters, to Steve Race and Humphrey Littleton, to say that they presented it in that way, because they didn't. You know, they gave the musicians space.
But it is interesting that character is turned into an archetype of the 60s.
Yes.
He usually wears a black polo,
that's right.
The beatnik referencing. So it, funnily enough, is supposed to be exactly that moment in jazz. And yet it is interesting that that's not what the BBC did. The BBC had its presenters in suits and ties.
Yeah.
The musicians are almost always dressed like that, often with a bow tie. This was an important and prestigious event, not a casual event.
Yeah.
The other thing is that the Fast Show sketch, it's clearly in a club, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the club changes and as the music changes and the lighting alters and so on. But 625 isn't really, even when it was in the Marquee Club, based in a club. It didn't try to recreate... Because we all have that notion that it's a smoky den of iniquity. I know whenever I play jazz records to my students, the visual picture that comes in is now the Fast Show.
Yeah.
And then secondly, a black and white picture of a smoky jazz club.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they're playing with things, but I just I wouldn't want people to imagine they're getting the fast show.
No, absolutely.
And theirs is a critique of all this sort of taking music too seriously and trying to be too cool, isn't it? That's what that's what the skit is about, really. So I just feel I want to defend 625.
No, well,
you can clearly see.
You've got the right audience here, anyway.
What's great, I think, about Jessica 25 as well is that the fast show skit gives you that sense that, yeah, take it too serious, but everything's so kind of, you know, atmospheric and nuanced and performed in this kind of really smooth way. There are really great bits in 625 which feel very jagged and feel very, if not under-rehearsed, but spontaneous and impromptu, as is entirely appropriate for a programme about jazz.
Yeah.
And you get that, I can't remember which episode it is. It might be the Modern Jazz Quartet, but, you know, where it's kind of, we don't have a title for this yet, so we'll just call it Blues.
Yeah, it's the Brubeck episode.
And it is very much a, well, here's something we kind of are still writing, really, but we're gonna play it because it's interesting and it's something we're doing now. Haven't got a title, so tough, you know, you just have to take that.
Well, in a rather charming way, Steve Race ends that by saying, maybe you can think of a title to the audience and maybe send in your ideas.
And that's
so radio, isn't it?
It's Jesus, you know, I'm sure he got a real telling off. Yeah. We don't do things like that on BBC Two. but the presenters are interesting. I mean, it's interesting the fast show tries. On some of the ones, they're experimental. You know, people blow down the trumpets the wrong way. I have to say, I love those skits, and I love the presentations of music on them because they're so well observed.
Yeah.
But I think it owed its tradition, 65 owed its tradition, to a different sort of notion of experimentality that you're talking about. You know, now and live and worked through and... you know, something in progress, and as a musician, as an audience, you're not observing the highly prepared and organised and polished piece of entertainment. You're privy to something that's happening in the moment, and it's much more to do with those traditions of drama experimentation. And I think the layouts of stage and audience most often reproduce those.
To some extent, I feel like that's lost when Jazz 65 gets used in clip shows.
Absolutely.
And so we lose that sequence that follows a band through a number of different pieces. And often you have little sort of explanatory notes at the bottom of the screen which gives you biographical information or, you know, there's a fantastic moment in one of the Ellington programmes where Ellington addresses the 1960s audience and says, I'm not going to tell you what the name of this track is because you're so hip, you'll know it anyway. But when that's used in, when that's repurposed in the 90s, the track is given underneath, you know, Perdido. So there's...
They didn't have to explain what hip meant either, did they?
Probably. But, I mean, 65 is now used a lot in remembrances of either certain artists who've played on the show, like Brubeck, but also in celebrations like the one that's coming up at the end of this month.
Yeah. Well, there's three things, interesting things to say there. On the first one is it's used because it exists.
Yes, yeah.
The second one is there's a real commitment within the contemporary BBC to use its archive. There's a sense within the corporation that its archive and that its history and that its traditions are its greatest asset. And BBC 4 stands for that. And if we actually wanted to understand what the contemporary BBC 2 is, it's BBC 4.
Yeah.
It's probably, if you like, the art strand that was imagined for BBC Two, remade for the 21st century. But the real strong emphasis, and it's useful because it makes programming cheaper, is to not make new things, but to use existing material.
Mm.
And then a large part about that is this is the 50th anniversary of, in this case, BBC Two. So you build your programming around a whole series of remembered events. As one author put it, a retromania, obsession with our past that people often link to a sort of postmodern world that has no future. 625 definitely had a future.
Yeah, a
notion that jazz was part of that. And if you read BBC 4's remit. It's very much about taking culture seriously, taking music, having an educational function.
Yeah.
But in practice, it tends too often to reduce things to a series of clips with bits of information underneath that will allow you, if you're a bit stupid or ignorant, to understand what's going on. Now, I mean, you know, to a lot of people, this is valuable things because they like the stuff, but they don't know an awful lot about it. So the BBC is doing them a real service. But I do feel that there's almost a notion that we couldn't show the whole programme, could we?
Yeah.
Because that was the 1960s and TV was just a bit boring then.
Mm.
And then you'd have to listen to those rather lame jokes and references to things we don't understand. So it's almost the feeling that it has to be more tightly edited.
Yeah.
More tightly packaged. And I suppose we should ask ourselves, well, how are those extracts used? And it's a number of ways. There are occasions when actually they do show whole programmes,
but they're
rare.
Yeah.
The main way that television is being remade, if you like, is in the documentary forms. So the footage of 625 is a great asset to the BBC because other people will buy it across the world, but they can reuse it in their own programming as well. So what does it get there? Well, you just get a little snippet of it, but we're not usually told it's 625.
No.
It usually represents that artist or a particular, even a particular song or a number that's being played. So it's almost the whole stripped awayness denies the history of the BBC itself.
And there's a great example in which a 1964 Jazz 65 episode of Dave Brubeck is used in an arena documentary about the year 1959.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Kind of goes back in time.
In fact, most of the stuff in that 1959, because it's about
the year
pivotal,
that changed jazz.
The changed jazz, isn't it? And almost none of it happened that we see. But that's the problem of being a programme maker when nobody kept TV. But the other place that we get the extracts, we do get an hour of 625. And I think that's what you were describing before, wasn't it? We'll get a whole number. And then under it, we'll get information as the number unfolds. Because we couldn't just sit there and listen to it and ask ourselves questions before we, the programme makers, already know the things we want answering, and so they give us that information. But what I think's exciting about something like BBC Four is it does make that stuff available.
Yes.
Then it gets onto YouTube, and it's consistently available for everybody, and for us as academics.
Oh, absolutely.
That's absolutely vital because I said before, one of the great things is we can see it. Without this, we would know very little beyond the sorts of written documents that you've been poring over, Nick, about exactly what it ended up like.
It's that splitting up of the programme, I think, is really interesting. And it's kind of problematic because a lot of the things that we've discussed here is how the programme works as a whole, like that it is about that link between the performance and the host and the audience and the television viewer across the programme, that the things that make it interesting are the things that make it distinct from the other programmes. So, you know, if you watch Top of the Pops, you get 10 different acts, each performing a number, one after the other. That innovation of having often, you know, one artist for the duration of the show, it's one of the things that makes it interesting, but it's one of the things that gets completely lost when you turn it into a clip show. Because what it does is it moves it from a programme about, in a way, a live concert, to it reduces it back to the number, to a compilation of individual songs. And you lose the sense of what's there, or what, in some ways, what's special about it. The good thing is that we get to see some of it. We don't just get to see, you know, the three episodes that are occasionally repeated, that we might see some, you know, a performance from something we haven't seen, you know, since the early 60s. And that's great. And I think, I mean, I think that, you know, the comment that this exists is, in some ways, you know, vital, because firstly it means that there's an archive there for people to go to, but it also says something probably about, I mean, you, Tim, you talked before about that these were, you know, these were put on film. That very fact seems to demonstrate an element of cultural value that the BBC itself thought, this is important enough that we won't just record examples, but actually all of them. We will keep all of them.
And I think it's a way that Terry Henneberry was able to get money, you know, to get musicians into the studio. He was able to convince the people who controlled the purse strings that actually it was important that one recorded Duke Ellington or Oscar Peterson or Art Blakey, you know.
When so many Top of the Pops from the 60s don't exist anymore, you know, huge numbers of those just aren't there.
I think the BBC still wants to take it seriously, and I you know, there's enough people knocking the BBC for us not to join them.
Yeah.
And we shouldn't, because it's so good that this is going to appear. But I think the thing that does disappoint me is all they want to, I feel, turn this into is here's some old jazz on television. And it was going to be interesting to see how it's going to be treated, because they almost want to downplay how valuable and important the corporation itself is. And I just always feel that they're missing an opportunity. Instead of just be to say, I mean, I know that often these programmes are called Jazz on the BBC or Rock on the BBC or Blues on the BBC, aren't they? The clip programmes are often called that. And yet, it's almost like incidental that it was on the BBC, or we owned it and we're now able to play it, when actually they were part of deciding to take this sort of music seriously. They were the people who innovated in technology that allowed us to hear it and see it in a way that we had never done before. And if we wanted to say something about the importance of the BBC in a multimedia hyper-commercial world where a large number of political forces want to stop it existing, that's what the BBC does for us.
Yeah.
And nobody else will take that as seriously in quite that way.
And I think all of the things that we've noted today, the sort of extraordinary formal qualities of Jazz 65, are just a great illustration of that.
Absolutely, you know?
Rick, I just wondered if you thought that any of the kind of elements of Jazz 65 that we've discussed are still felt in music programming today?
In some ways, I don't want to be too hyperbolic and to say, well, if we watch later with Jules Holland, we could see 625 with a different presenter. but I don't think you can't. I don't want to be too double negative here, but I don't think you can't not say that in some ways.
Yeah.
I think what we can clearly say is that what Jazz 625 is the first programming, the first of a series of innovative programmes that appear on BBC Two, music programmes. You know, I'm thinking you get things later on in the 60s, things like Late Night Lineup, which is a kind of magazine programme, chat show type thing, which has musical sections. And then moving into things like Colour Me Pop, significantly the Old Grey Whistle Test, in concert series and things like that. Rock Goes to College in the late 70s, early 80s, where it's, you know, there's actually a group, you know, we're at the University of Warwick today, there's a brilliant Susie and the Banshees.
And that started as Jazz Goes to College.
Yeah. So you've kind of got that, and then moving through things like, you know, later with Jules Holland, which we've had from the early 90s through. I think what all of these things have in common, going back to the things that I was saying earlier, is that emphasis on liveness, but these are all about getting people in and playing things live, where it's about the musicians showing off their musical abilities and stage performances rather than miming to records, miming to a product that you already know and that you've already got at home. I think in some ways, stuff like the Goes to College series and the In Concert series are maybe more like 65, in that what you tend to have is, you know, one artist for the duration of the programme. And obviously things like MTV Unplugged have that kind of similar thing. But I think I would say that what we can still see in things like the Old Grey Whistle Test and later is something of a fusion of that kind of diversity that we get with something like Top of the Pops or Ready Steady Go, lots of different artists, with that kind of live approach, an innovative style of filming that is interested in the performance rather than just showing it. So you kind of in a way have a lineup, the content that's a bit like Top of the Pops, but a style that is quite like, it comes from 625, Jazz 65. And I wouldn't say that, you know, the people who, you know, create later go, well, what we want is to look like Jazz 65. But they could quite conceivably have said, we want it to look, be a contemporary version of the old grey whistle test. And I think the old grey, and I think that lineage goes right back to the opening night of BBC Two. And all of these programmes are BBC Two programmes. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like, you know, this is the first one and we move from there. And it, and we're still in a position where live music on television, you know, is still a thing and is still really one of the landmark aspects of BBC Two's output. And I think you can draw a direct line from that first night to, you know, to Friday night when we'll have another later with Jules Holland, and you can kind of still see that it's an important aspect of the channel.
I think you're absolutely right about that. You could take either of them and the programmes and superimpose stills of them on top of each other.
Yeah.
All the things we were talking about before, the seeing the musicians' hands, the seeing their faces, the Jules, you know, Jules Holland really is a 625 presenter. He is Humphrey Lyttelton in many ways, the serious musician who has the ironic side, but everybody knows and everybody knows that he can and sometimes does sit in and perform with you. But he also, I think, is directly the notion of the role of the BBC that was established by Pilkington that you talked about right at the beginning, directly the programming. I mean, later, Jules Holland comes out of The Late Show, which is an attempt to remake arts programming. So it is that division that we keep bringing up between the notion that pop music is light or entertainment or variety, or it's serious and it's art. And 625 and later with Jules Holland know very clearly which side of that divide it's on.
I mean, one perhaps distinction we could make is that Jules does have the responsibility of moving the camera around to the next band, and there's a wonderful example of a show a few years ago where McCoy Tyner's playing and Tyner doesn't want to stop playing, and so Jules comes on and goes back off again, and you can feel for the cameraman because he stays with McCoy Tyner, and eventually they have to go. But
at least they stayed with the musician.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that demonstrates, you know, that idea. You've got Jules, you've got Lyttelton. Tim, as you mentioned, these are musicians. These are not DJs. Yeah. This isn't Jimmy Savile, who's knows how to get you from one record to the next.
Yeah.
This is somebody who is a musician, understands how the music is played and performed, and the importance of that, and the importance that that needs to be carried through in the presentation of the television programme, and that's the important thing. Cutting the musician off really is the last thing you need to do. And you can see in that clip that you mentioned, I think it is on YouTube still, Jules is kind of like, I don't know what to do here, because this is the Tuesday night live show. This isn't the pre-record that goes out the Friday. This is, we've got 4 minutes and we need to try and squeeze in Elbow.
Who people really have tuned in for.
And he comes in, you know.
And he steps back.
He steps back and goes, well, ideally we need to finish, but I'm not going to interrupt this performance. And there is not a doubt that I think if you know, it's live, so that's interesting. But there's not a doubt that if you had Tony Blackburn doing, I mean, it wouldn't be Tony Blackburn now, but you know, I don't know.
A Tony Blackburn figure. Yeah,
a Tony Blackburn figure. That Edith Bowman or Joe Wiley, that they would move the camera out of the way and they'd start talking and they'd fade the background down.
Yeah.
Jules, as a musician, I think understands that you don't really want to do that if you can help it. And I think that goes all the way back to having musicians as presenters on 625.
That may be a good spot to end on. Jazz 625 at the BBC is broadcast on BBC 4 on Saturday, the 24th of May, but the exact scheduling has yet to be announced. Just like to thank Richard and Tim. I've had a great time. Hope
and
you
me.
Have too.
Thank you. It's been great. Okay. Talk about jazz. It's great.